This really comes out of some work I've been doing over the last 4 to 5 years on looking at sort of war in a war and conflict in a much more sort of general sense. Well, different aspects of that. And this is sort of new work I'm doing that I've been working on the last 5 to 6 months, really, looking at this relationship between war and beauty, trying to draw out some themes around that. And the presentation I'm doing here isn't a sort of finished paper. I'm not going to sit here and say da, 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 da. It's very much a sort of work in progress piece. So it's going to be a little bit rough around the edges, perhaps, and I'm going to go off at various sort of tangents and things. So you'll have to let me do that, if you will. And but hopefully, there's sort of something interesting there for you. And I suppose just to sort of introduce it then. I've been working on areas related to this for a while, and I'm interested in thinking about beauty's role in war as a sort of active agent in war. I think thinking about this relationship between war and sort of beauty isn't something that's maybe particularly fashionable. And I'm interested in how we can think about war maybe in different ways, how we can sort of rethink war, if you like. And so I was, as I said, this is sort of developed out of thinking about how beauty, rather than just a sort of passive category, if you like, plays a role as an active agent in warfare. So I'm trying to sort of press that idea. As I say, maybe not something that's been thought about too much, certainly more sort of recently. So it's really concerned with what beauty can tell us about war, but also what war might be able to tell us about how we think about beauty. And it is beauty that I'm really looking at here. Often, if we look back at the history of aesthetics, it's beauty's relationship to the sublime that is often drawn out as a particular way of thinking about some of these themes. And it might be that when one first thinks of this relationship, it's the sublime that one thinks of first, war and the sublime, perhaps, rather than war and beauty. I'm going to, as I'll touch upon at various points in this paper, I'm interested in thinking about the sublime, but it's actually beauty I'm particularly concerned with. There is that relationship running through this, but it's really beauty I'm really going to focus on. Okay, so my first theme that I want to really introduce this sort of topic through is the place of beauty in war. Of trying to frame this sort of question, how do we think about beauty as being an aspect, a part of warfare? And I think, what's the place it sort of occupies within war? And I think contemporary attitudes to war, we're not encouraged to think about war as having beauty within it, beauty seen as something separate. We're sort of led to think of war as ugly, horrific, barbarous, something that has to be undertaken, but undertaken in a sort of way that sort of places it as something that isn't something that we like to think of in positive terms that a term like beauty sketches out for us. So there's this sort of disjunction, I think, between these sort of two terms in contemporary thinking. And yet, if we look back over the history of this relationship, we can find a very different tradition. One which I call a sort of martial tradition that finds in war beauty as sort of being there in war, that seeks to glorify war, idealise war, that sort of revels in war as a sort of positive experience in which virtues such as beauty can be found. And you can trace this back to Homer, and you can trace it back much more recently to World War I, say, and the futurists, Ernst Jünger, and people like that who see war in this much more positive way. And yet I think it's wrong to sort of simply think about finding beauty in war only in those terms. That beauty can be found in war and therefore is doing something in war as simply part of that martial tradition is wrong, I think. And here, the sort of figure I want to draw on to sort of try and argue this is Marcel Proust. Okay, I've got a rather lengthy quote from the last volume of Proust's novel, Time Regained, 1922. It's the night of the 28th of July, 1917. Proust has been dining at the Ritz, and an air raid siren has sounded. And from the balcony, he observes a Zeppelin raid. And this is what Proust's companion says to him. He went on to ask me if I had a good view. Very much as in the old days, he might have questioned me about some spectacle of aesthetic beauty. At the front, I could see there might be a sort of bravado in saying, isn't it marvellous, what a pink and that pale green, when at any moment you might be killed. But here in Paris, there could be no question of any such pose in Saint-Loup's way of speaking about an insignificant raid, which had in fact looked marvellously beautiful from our balcony when the silence of the night was broken by a display which was more than a display because it was real, with fireworks that were purposeful and protective and bugle calls that did more than summon on parade. I spoke of the beauty of the aeroplanes climbing up into the night, and perhaps they are even more beautiful when they come down, he said. Proust's account of this action, which reaches beyond this particular extract, is of particular significance, I think, for the way in which it presents a figure of his stature in the development of Western literature and Western culture more broadly, and a figure that firmly stands outside of this martial tradition, finding beauty in war. Indeed, Proust disavows in this comment the bravado of such a position. In so doing, this section from Proust's work asserts that the finding of beauty in war cannot be reduced to or simply equated with this martial tradition. Rather, Proust, the unsurpassed depictor of the aesthetics of the minutiae of everyday life, brings war into the more general aesthetic economy that he develops across the thousands of pages of his work. Here, the spectacle of aesthetic beauty presented by the Zeppelin raid takes its place amongst the myriad of other forms and sources of aesthetic experience he traces in a work that might be read as an encyclopedia of these experiences. Indeed, in a relatively recent biography of Proust by Jean-Yves Tadié argues that for Proust, quote, war became like painting, music and architecture. In so doing, Proust's work suggests the following formula, and this is the point I'm driving at here in taking Proust's work as a particular example. If we can find beauty in these other domains, we have to admit that we can find it in war as well. So if we can find it in painting, music and architecture, if we can follow Proust in finding beauty there, then how can we say that beauty can't also be found in war? That's the argument I'm sort of making. We can maybe talk about that afterwards. People are rather sceptical about it. Okay. In so doing, Proust's work points to the conflicted and problematic relationship between ethics and aesthetics, which dogs depictions of war, and I think limits the way we want to or can think about the relationships. I mean, let me just check my next slide. Yeah, limits the way we might want to think about the relationship between beauty and war. And I think this is very evident in a relatively recent example, the September the 11th attacks on New York, and the particular response there to two comments that were sort of made about those about those strikes, those acts. First, there was the German composer Karlheinz Stockhausen's comments that were made 5 days after the September the 11th, September the 11th attacks, in which, speaking at the Hamburg Music Festival, he described them as the greatest work of art, achieving in one act something which we couldn't even dream of in music. There was a big controversy around these statements, and he had to say he was sort of misquoted and say how sort of wrong he'd be. And then a sort of year after the New York strikes, Damien Hirst, talking about the anniversary of them on the BBC's news website, made a sort of similar comment, describing them as an artwork in their own right that were visually stunning. Again, he had to issue a swift back down and say how sort of wrong he'd been, he'd been taken out of context, etc. Both those comments and both the responses to them, I think, reveal this sort of sense of drawing any parallels between beauty and conflict in a sort of contemporary context risk broaching this sort of ethical dubiousness, this ethical questioning. Okay. And whilst I'm sort of stressing the sort of contemporary nature of that, there's nothing necessarily particularly new about that. I'm not making an argument that this is only a sort of new thing. There's a sort of much longer history there. And we can sort of think about, I suppose, thinking a bit more broadly about those sort of questions. We might sort of look back to sort of work like Edmund Burke's work, particularly his essay "Origins of Our Ideas of the Sublime." Origins of Our Ideas of the Sublime and the Beautiful, from 1757, in which he sort of asks questions about people's desire to actually witness disasters. He talks about people wanting to see executions and wanting to see witness the destruction of London. So there's a sort of sense there that these things that we like to position as distasteful, ethically complex, difficult, there sort of is this desire to actually also witness them, see them, and paint them in these terms. What I'm trying to not particularly clearly set up here, I sort of should have said it in a bit more sort of clearer terms, is there's a sort of tension between finding beauty in war and the sort of ethics of actually doing that. And you can make a sort of argument that one of the reasons why maybe beauty hasn't been thought about as an agent in warfare is precisely because of that ethical injunction, because making an argument like that is seen as a sort of problematic argument. I think there are other reasons as well, and I don't want to overstress that, but I want to raise the ethical as a particular category because I'm going to come back to that. I think secondary to that is the whole way in which war has maybe been looked at by certain academic disciplines in certain terms, and that certain academic disciplines are not particularly concerned with thinking about beauty as a sort of agent in war, when they can turn to what for them are their particular areas of interest, and they can say, well, this is, you know, we are X discipline and we're particularly interested in such things. So what I'm sort of trying to sort of argue here is that beauty hasn't been particularly thought about as an agent in war for these type of reasons. Okay, this is really still a introduction to what I'm sort of building up to. But what I really want to move on to now is to, and what I sort of haven't done so far, is look at beauty as an active agent. At the moment, I'm talking about how beauty can be found in war, in warfare. It has been read as sort of being present in war. For the rest of what I want to talk about is something much more interesting, I think, and much more significant, perhaps, is that And also make a sort of bolder claim that beauty does things in war, that it actually shapes wars, conflicts. Okay, so the first aspect of this I want to look at is actually the least clear, the most difficult to sort of pin down, the least precise way of thinking about this war and beauty relationship. And yet I have to talk about it first for sort of reasons that will become relatively obvious in terms of the sort of stages I want to move through. And it's beauty as a cause of war. Beauty is casus belli. What does it mean to think of beauty as a cause of or contributing to war? That's what I want to, that's the point I want to talk about now. How can we find a place for beauty amongst the more seemingly straightforward and substantive factors typically identified as leading by themselves or in combination to war? The economic, the ethno-nationalist, the territorial, the ideological, and the religious. Okay, so how can we seriously think about beauty as a cause of war? Is there anything worth saying there? How can we think about that relationship? And I want to take as my starting point the judgment of Paris, this sort of mythical scene in which Paris is asked to choose between the Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite. Okay, and as we hopefully all know, his choice is Aphrodite. He chooses Aphrodite, and in so doing, there's a sort of double gesture towards him choosing beauty. It's not just that this choice he's asked to make is the most beautiful of the three. It's not just that he does it in those terms. It's that what he's promised by each of these goddesses as his prize for choosing them follows this logic of beauty being the most important aspect of his choice through. Hera promises him property and power. Athena promises him military strength, victory. But it's Aphrodite who promises him only beauty. Helen, only beauty. And yet this is what Paris chooses. And obviously he chooses Helen, and this leads to the Trojan War, the war, if you like, in Western history, Western culture, the sort of war that we constantly refer back to as a sort of first war, as a sort of template for these things. Okay, so it's this choice of beauty that leads to war, as this sort of fundamental relationship there in the myth. I want to come back to that. I think it would be if we look at sort of scholarship on the Trojan War, scholarship points to it actually having taken place, or at least a version of it having taken place, and it points to it as a trade war, a war over economics, a war over trade routes through the Bosphorus, and for a sort of struggle for power in the eastern Mediterranean more broadly. So how do we get them? I think it's interesting to sort of think about how we have a sort of trade war being translated into this myth of a choice of beauty. So it would be illuminating to be able to trace the genealogy of the myth of Paris's choice and Helen's abduction, and to plot how a war over trade routes transmutes into the story of Paris's choice and Helen's capture, and the questions this raises for understanding myth's capacity to transform the truth into fantasy in a way that in turn seeks to reveal something else, some broader truth to us. In so doing, it raises the sort of quizzical question, is trade enough of an ideal to actually go to war for? Is not this myth saying, well, actually, beauty is a sort of more important, more plausible, more significant reason why you should go to war? That this myth has had a purchase and has replaced the historical basis of the trade war that was the real Trojan War. And yet, rather than thinking about this question in terms of the sort of cause of the Trojan War, in terms of an either-or myth or history, I think what this particular myth and this relationship raises is the question of the relationship between beauty and the way we think about the causes of war that are more traditionally thought about, the economic, the ethno-nationalist, the ideological, the religious. What happens if we think about beauty's relationship to these factors? Beauty isn't something that just exists by itself. There isn't ever a sense of beauty as a sort of separated off realm, something completely abstracted. Beauty is always something that takes on certain forms, certain shapes. It exists within cultures. Okay. And if we actually, and so what I'm trying to do here is to think beauty's relationship to these other causes of war, and hence try to get at how we can think about beauty as a factor in war, in causing war. So if you think about economics as a cause of war, we need to think about what beauty's relationship is to economics, how beauty is always based upon the use of certain material resources, the sort of distribution of economic wealth that actually allows beauty to be made. If we think about ideological causes of warfare, we need to think about how ideologies define certain things as beautiful, have a certain conception of what beauty is and what beauty isn't. If we think about the ethno-nationalist causes of warfare, again, beauty is having certain boundaries, as one ethnic group's conception of beauty not the same as a different ethnic group's conception of beauty. The sense in which beauty, however difficult it is to try and delineate that relationship, is always bound up with it with a series of other factors which we do think of as being causes of warfare in more traditional terms. What I'm trying to get at here is how we think beauty's relationship to these other more substantive factors. Okay. A very important work in this respect is Joseph Chytrees. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. I think that's APA. Joseph Chytrees, the Aesthetic State. A work published in, I think it was in the 80s. I haven't got the reference written there properly. I think it's in the 80s. A very, very interesting book in which he argues for the primacy of the order of the aesthetic to German thinking about politics and about statehood from the 17th century to the mid 20th century. That the ideal of an aesthetic state was a sort of leading drive, not a sort of secondary factor, not a tertiary factor, but was a leading drive in political thought in that period. That thinking about states was fundamentally bound up with thinking about them as having was thinking about the aesthetic as playing a sort of driving role in that. This German thought in that period is not just confined in those conceptions to thinking about German states in that period. He sort of sketches how those ideas were traced back to, in that work and in other work, can be traced back to ancient Greece, and he sort of takes it forward from there. There's the sense that it's sort of constantly playing a sort of role, beauty is. Okay, what both those factors, beauty's relationship to the causes of war and Chytrees's work reveals, I think, is the need to think about different societies, cultures, in terms of the position of the will to beauty if you like, if you want to term it in that way, a sort of drive to beauty as playing a sort of fundamental role within how they think about themselves and how they think about other societies which they might fight. And we can see this, I think, in the status, talking in very broad terms here, we can see this in the sort of status societies give to art, architecture, etc. That these are fundamental statements of the identity, power, wealth of societies. And therefore what societies, when they engage in acts of war, are actually fighting for, that beauty is fundamentally bound up with that. That's what I'm sort of trying to argue. I think perhaps we, in terms of actual politics and aesthetics and thinking that relationship, this is perhaps most clearly visible in the sort of broadly totalitarian projects of the 20th century. Nazi Germany, also the Soviet Union, in which aesthetic questions come to deeply permeate, I'd argue, particularly for the Nazi regime, come to deeply permeate political thinking, but also how politics is actually played out, how politics is performed. Okay, just to sort of round this section off then. Coming back to Chaitry's work then, he sees the judgment of Paris as serving to, within Western history if you like, initiate the aesthetic judgment itself. That's a sort of quote from his work. This act serves to initiate aesthetic judgment, how we think about what beauty is, isn't, and so forth. And that he's not as concerned with this, but for the sort of sake of what I'm arguing, talking about, is that this act leads directly to warfare, the Western culture's war. So the aesthetic judgment is bound to war. And therefore, how to think that relationship in the terms I've been saying. There sort of is a need to think about the order of the aesthetic beauty in terms of warfare. Okay. Again, that was a rather vague, perhaps, you're sort of thinking, okay, he's introducing this topic, fine. Now I want to get on to how am I doing time-wise? I'm still doing, okay. I'm running a little bit slower than I hoped, so if I can just carry on at this bit. Okay, now I want to move on to some more substantive areas. I've been sketching again and again a sort of backdrop for these arguments, perhaps. And now I want to look at the two fundamental dynamics of warfare, if you like, and to really get to grips with this sense of how beauty can be an actor. So the first section of, I forget what slides I've got, yeah. The first section I want to talk about in this, the first dynamic is beauty as a target in warfare. Beauty that's specifically targeted as something to attack, to strike at. Okay. I want to lead into this by thinking about Dubrovnik, the siege of Dubrovnik in the breakup of former Yugoslavia. Okay, Dubrovnik was besieged by Yugoslav National Army forces / Serbian forces in a three-month period, essentially, in 1991, October to December in 1991. It was besieged, it was extensively shelled, and there was an international outcry about this. And this map here shows Dubrovnik's old town, the sort of historic core, and it shows how much it was actually bombed. I'm not going to talk too much about that map, but each of these dots symbolises a sort of different type of strike. It was heavily shelled over this period, and there was an international outcry, partly focusing on the fact that it was this old place, not old places, city, putting it, was this particular place of historical, architectural, cultural value that was being targeted. Seemingly because it was a place of architectural value. The actual military strategic significance of the old town was, you could argue, nil. there actually wasn't a particular military strategic tactical point to shelling it, sieging it. And yes, this took place over an extended period, extensive damage to the old town. Certainly in a very interesting volume, partly written during the siege, but by different writers, and published subsequently after the siege, the argument is made in this repeatedly that it was Dubrovnik's beauty that was precisely being targeted. That Dubrovnik's beauty, the beauty of the old town, the beauty of its architecture, and what that beauty stood for, was why it was being so targeted by the JNA and the Serb forces. It's the essays in that book are written from a very particular standpoint, and yet if we turn to the findings of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia, the ICTU, they in much more sober terms argue a very similar thing. The trial of Miodrag Djokic, I apologise for my pronunciation of these things. If you just want to sort of read through this is their findings that came out in 2004. The old town of Dubrovnik was protected not only under the 1954 Hague Convention on the Protection of Cultural Property in the event of armed conflict, but also as a UNESCO World Cultural Heritage Site. It was an outstanding architectural site, illustrating a significant stage in human history and cultural achievement. The shelling attack on the old town was an attack not only against the history and heritage of the region, but also against the cultural heritage of the whole of mankind. The trial chamber has found that this is a crime representing a violation of a specially protected value. The crime was particularly serious in the present case. That's, one of the key terms there for me. Particularly serious in the present case because the old town was in its entirety listed as a protected UNESCO site. Residential buildings within the city were therefore specially protected together with the rest of the site as an outstanding architectural site, illustrating a significant stage in the history of humankind. Not only does the ICTU argue that, it argues that these things were targeted by Serb forces exactly for that reason. And the findings emphasise that the military, strategic, tactical value of the place was highly limited. And it turns to this as an explanation, partly. And, you know, and all these arguments, I'm not going to go too far and say beauty is the answer. That's an absurd thing to argue. But partly, it's luring people, you know, this sense of this. Okay, so how to make sense then, moving away from the specific example of Dubrovnik, how to make sense of this desire to destroy beauty? I think the absolutely fundamental thing to grasp here, and the question to ask is what beauty does, how it works. And turning to Lacan's work in his seminar on the gaze, he sort of argues that painting, he's talking about painting, but I think we can talk about beauty here in a more general sense. He uses this interesting term that painting, and I want to argue beauty, acts as a lure. It's something that draws people in. It acts as a lure. This is beauty draws people to it, either to sort of look at it or other things as well. That it compels people towards it. Acts as a lure. And yet, in times of conflict, we see, in this case I've just been talking about, in the former Yugoslavia, it acts as if the enemy possesses beauty, it possesses a lure that draws people to it, and yet the enemy is supposed to be a side, a culture that you're fighting, that you're supposed to be hostile to, and it sets, and therefore beauty in times of war sets up this very complex that another possesses beauty, and B, frustration that it isn't or can't be possessed by the aggressor. And there's that dual relationship, if you like. And it's interesting that in one of the essays in this Dubrovnik in War book, there's an essay by Bozidar Violic. He talks actually in very, very similar terms in thinking about Dubrovnik's position to that sketched by Pacto. He says, the root of their hatred, this is the Serbs, lies in the desperation that another possesses beauty, and B, frustration that it isn't or can't be possessed by the aggressor. And so there's that dual relationship, if you like. And it's interesting that in one of the essays in this Dubrovnik in War book, there's an essay by Bozidar Violic. He talks actually in very, very similar terms in thinking about Dubrovnik's position to that sketched by Pactow. He says, the root of their hatred, this is the Serbs, lies in the desperation, envy and bitterness to which they feel towards shape, purity and beauty, which is not theirs. Destruction is the only way left to them, a hopeless consolation which is extinguished each time the devastation stops. It exposes their own tragic position. Not only do they know that they do not possess it as in the sort of beauty of the place, but they clearly feel that they will be unable to have it in their lifetimes. Okay, I think what these arguments about beauty are pointing towards is something where perhaps a more simple fundamental relationship that we see in wartime, in which if the other side has these beautiful things, if you like, these become, these occupy the position of venerated objects for that side. And that in striking at these venerated objects, what you're doing is striking at the manifestations of the wealth, identity, power, and difference of that culture that you're engaged in war with. So that, as I'm saying, beauty represents something profound at the core of a culture, and that's why it gets raised up as a target. You're fighting that culture, you're trying to destroy that side, and therefore you target beauty. And there's the whole question of how this perhaps takes on a particular resonance for, in times of conflict, for neighbouring people's countries. The relationship of the neighbour there is, I think, particularly interesting. And in the case of Dubrovnik and Yugoslavia, particularly interesting, I think, in the context of a country that had been existing under a sort of single flag, although Yugoslavia was always more complex than that, and then gets broken up, and which sides say, well, actually, this is now ours. It hasn't been just ours for a substantial period of time, but now it is, in the sense in which, well, who's taking what from whom there? Well, I could go on about that long, but I'm going to press on for the sake of time. Okay, so that's the sort of city element, the sort of the beauty of a place, the beauty of an architecture, the beauty of a culture as occupying the role of target. And now I want to talk briefly about art, the way in which art comes to figure as a target in wartime. And two particular dynamics to this. The destruction of art, the willful targeting of art, somebody else's art. I'm just going to point to one example here, because this really follows on from this type of motives I've been talking about previously. And it's the Nazis in Poland, the Nazis' invasion of Poland. There's lots of different examples I sort of could point to here, but I want to move through this bit relatively quickly. The Nazis in Poland targeting monasteries, shrines that didn't have any particular value in military terms again, but targeting them precisely because they were seen as beautiful manifestations of Polish culture, and the particular distaste the Nazis had for Poland and Polish culture. And I'm going to contrast that a bit later on with their different relationship to Italian culture. So you sort of get things like the monastery that housed the picture of Our Lady of Częstochowa being bombed, not for any seemingly significant military reason, precisely because it did occupy this position within Polish culture. So it's a sort of way of exterminating, denigrating exactly what I was talking about, the wealth, the power, the identity of that particular culture that you want to destroy. But there's a sort of second dynamic here as well that I think is more interesting perhaps, and that's the looting of the enemy's artworks. The way in which military victories lead to artworks being taken by the side who was doing the invading it, if you like. Two examples here, just sort of briefly. Nazis, again, engaging in looting of the countries they invaded generally, particular examples of that. I'm not going to go back over the Nazis particularly, but also Napoleon's victories, leading to this process in quite clear, quite staggering striking terms. So, I'm just going to take a pause for a second. I'm getting a bit tired. Napoleon's invasion of other European countries, leading to the mass accumulation of art treasures. So in 1806, his victory at Jena leads to hundreds of paintings being taken from Prussia. 1809, the fall of Vienna leads to 400 art objects being taken from that city. And what I think is particularly fascinating here is that is the way in which this process is absolutely bound up with the founding of the public museum. If we look at the founding of the Louvre, it's absolutely built on the sort of first modern European museum. It's absolutely built on this plunder of Europe. And there was a recent piece in the New York Review of Books in which Brooks talks about this in a sort of telling quote. He sees the Louvre built on the systematic looting of Western Europe and Egypt. So in this context, a museum like the Louvre becomes a place in which the plunder of war, the taking of the other side's beautiful objects, what the other side possesses that is beautiful, these objects become cited, stored, preserved, venerated, and exhibited there. Museums is almost like a trophy cabinet of military success. The beauty of other cultures being taken and then put on display to sort of demonstrate military victory, military prowess, military might. What I'm certainly not arguing here is that this is a reason why nations go to war. It's difficult to find examples of nations going to war to sort of get art artifacts. And yet it's a very interesting symptom of military conflicts that this is what repeatedly takes place, that plundering, looting becomes a sort of byproduct of that process. That there's a sort of struggle for beauty going on there to actually take beauty from the other side. Okay, the sort of last dynamic to this beauty as target is rape and sexual violence. A different conception of beauty. Talked about art, talked about cities and places, the beauty of the place. Beauty is linked, as Pachtow talks about at length in her work, beauty is bound up with the feminine. and the way in which rape and sexual violence in wartime becomes a way of striking at the other side's feminine qualities, feminine beauty, the manifestation of beauty in the feminine. And here I think Joanna Burke's relatively recent work on rape is particularly interesting. In a sort of chapter of that, she talks about how rape is prevalent in warfare. She talks about how much it is prevalent there. She talks about its use as a training technique, etc. The way she sort of draws this relationship between warfare and rape as a sort of fundamentally strong relationship. And I think it's sort of interesting, as I've been sort of saying, that rape is being used to sort of strike at the beauty the other side possesses. And again, this dynamic of at once beauty being a sort of lure that provokes desire, which we see in the desire to indulge in a sexual act. And yet it's not simply that. It's also, rape is also a expression of aggression towards that person. So there's this sort of dual relationship again going on there. Beauty is playing out in war in terms of lure and this desire to sort of denigrate something. We see this repeatedly in the examples of the use of rape in wartime. That just to commit the act of rape isn't enough for one particular side. That they have to denigrate and destroy the person who was raped as well. And a sort of key example here is the rape of Nanking by the Japanese in 1937 to 1938. This sort of mass rapes that took place there that were repeatedly accompanied by the mutilation of the bodies that had been violated. That it's not enough to sort of commit this barbarous, hideous act. You have to then demonstrate that this is actually about more than just desiring the other side and being able to violate the other side. You have to destroy and maim as well. Burke also talks about beauty as a threat. In talking about rape, she talks about the way in which, she's talking about the Vietnam War here, particularly. And she has quotes from sort of US servicemen who say when they were serving in Vietnam, they often saw women as more of a potential threat than men. They were never certain about their. There was a greater degree of uncertainty around women's roles and what women could potentially do than there often was with men. And And I think, I mean, that's interesting in its sort of own right, but the sort of broader point being made there, I think, is how we sort of think about beauty as a potentially threatening presence. And this does take us into the relationship between beauty and the sublime, the sense in which the sublime has been traditionally thought about as a category in which beauty is pushed so far that it becomes a sort of threatening, overwhelming thing. And that beauty often thought about as something, well, not actually, it sort of depends very much who you sort of read on this, how much beauty and the sublime are sort of seen as sort of separate things. They've been talked about as separate things, they've also talked about as sort of overlapping. But the sense in which beauty, if we think about the sublime beauty relationship as more than just a sort of divided up thing, but a sort of overlapping thing, the way in which beauty possesses this threatening potential, Burke talks about that in terms of sexual violence and rape. I think you can talk about it much more broadly in terms I've been talking about sort of previously, that beauty is considered threatening, and perhaps why we see beauty being targeted generally is because it is this expression of an enemy's wealth, power, difference. That you have to target this because this is what threatens you. If this other culture is able to produce these spectacular, marvellous, venerated, beautiful things, it must have a certain power. And that in fighting that culture, you have to try and destroy those supreme manifestations of its identity, wealth and power, to show that it can be defeated. Okay. Realising going on a little bit longer than I intended, but I'm coming into the home straight now, and this section's a sort of little bit shorter. And then this sort of ends it. Okay, beauty is defence. So I said two fundamental dynamics. Beauty is a target, and beauty is a defence. How beauty, this question of how beauty functions as a means of defence and a source of protection. And again, as with the judgment of Paris, I want to just very briefly point to a sort of mythico-historical underpinning of this, again, in the case of the Trojan War. At the end of the Trojan War, the king of Sparta, Menelaus, finds his wife, who'd been taken from him, in the ruins of Troy. He sort of finds her standing there. This is what's depicted in the scene. Menelaus is over on the left, Helen's in the centre. And he's intending to finish her off, to sort of slay her, kill her, because of the grief he's caused in the 10-year conflict that she's caused, etc. So he reaches for his sword and is about to strike her down and kill her. At which point she disrobes and shows Menelaus her naked body, and he finds that he can't kill her. Okay? The point being that beauty has an ability. Going into all that here is sort of secondary to what I'm talking about. Okay, so how does this play out beyond the theoretical and beyond the mythico-historical? In real terms, does it make any sense to think of beauty in this way? Again, Dubrovnik. No, it's a different example. Again, Dubrovnik, the outcry generated around the shelling of the city, a specific outcry, an international outcry, I sort of remember it at the sort of time. There's a lot of discussion about why is this thing being done to this very beautiful place, etc., etc. It didn't necessarily do anything at the actual time to defend Dubrovnik. There were calls for sort of UN intervention, to something to be done specifically about Dubrovnik's situation. There was a sort of international public outcry. Didn't do anything at the time. It certainly, as we've seen in the trial transcripts, did have a purchase later on. So beauty's ability to act as a defence there, with a question mark over it, certainly. But sort of later on, beauty as actually doing something. It's the way in which beauty can act in this way is more clearly evident, though. If we look at World War II and the notion of the open city, Rome being declared precisely that. Rome, once the Allies have invaded Italy, at a certain point in the history of it, Rome being talked about in these terms as a place that wasn't going to be defended, and therefore you sort of didn't need to bombard it because of its significance within Western culture, supposedly, purportedly. In fact, all the sort of documents do point to that. That Rome, seen as both the Axis powers and the Allied powers, as something that neither side wanted to desecrate, that it was too much to go into all that here is sort of secondary to what I'm talking about. Okay, so how does this play out beyond the theoretical and beyond the mythico-historical, in real terms? Does it make any sense to think of beauty in this way? Again, Dubrovnik. No, it's a different example. Again, Dubrovnik. The outcry generated around the shelling of the city, a specific outcry, an international outcry, I sort of remember it at the sort of time. There's a lot of discussion about why is this thing being done to this very beautiful place, etc., etc. It didn't necessarily do anything at the actual time to defend Dubrovnik. There were coups that. You see a similar situation in Florence as well. Hitler was very reluctant to fight over Florence because he saw it as occupying this particular conception, particular position within his conception of Europa, of his version of Europe, in a way that Poland, say, didn't. Florence was considered, you know, we aren't going to be the side that reduces Florence to rubble. As it turned out there, as it didn't turn out within Rome, Florence actually did become heavily damaged because events took a certain course. And there's also rumours about Oxford calls for sort of UN intervention. It's something to be done specifically about Dubrovnik's situation. There was a sort of international public outcry. Didn't do anything at the time. It certainly, as we've seen in the trial transcripts, did have a purchase later on. So Beauty's ability to act as a defence there with a question mark over it, certainly. But sort of later on, Beauty as actually doing something. It's the way in which Beauty can act in this way is more clearly evident, though. If we look at World War II and the notion of the open city, Rome not being bombed. I don't know, I need to do more work on that, whether there are rumours or whether there's a truth there. Oxford not being bombed, precisely because the Nazis saw it as something you didn't do. Heidelberg is the German equivalent of that. Talked about, again, I'm not sure on this. Heidelberg talked again about, in similar terms, the Allies were never going to bomb Heidelberg because you don't do that. Extremely interesting, I think, in thinking of the sort of aesthetics, politics relationship. Two sides involved in mass world war against each other, total war, if you like. And yet the aesthetic seemingly being able to occupy this privileged position. They're able to say, well, actually, no, aesthetics is here. In these examples, they declared precisely that. Rome, once the Allies have invaded Italy, at a certain point, the history of Rome being talked about in these terms as a place that wasn't going to be defended, and therefore you sort of didn't need to bombard it because of its significance within Western culture, supposedly, purportedly. In fact, all the sort of documents do point to that. That Rome, seen by both sides, both the Axis powers and the Allied powers, as something that neither side wanted to desecrate, that it was too much to do in a position above politics. Very interesting for thinking about the aesthetics-politics relationship. Okay, and yet there's a darker side to this very dynamic. What I call the way in which Beauty sets up a hierarchy of significance, if you like, that because that in labelling certain places as beautiful, that's possessing beauty, it's possessing aesthetic value, they're seen as having a certain importance that other places don't have, that they're given a status that sort of other places aren't given, that reveals how beauty can serve to protect in singling out who that. You see a similar situation in Florence as well. Hitler was very reluctant to fight over Florence because he saw it as occupying this particular position within his conception of Europa, of his version of Europe, in a way that Poland, say, didn't. Florence was considered, you know, we aren't going to be the side that reduces Florence to rubble. As it turned out there, as it didn't turn out within Rome, Florence actually did become heavily damaged because events took a certain course. And there's also rumours about Oxford, certain places, as worthy of protection, but then reveals the sort of difficulty in making that judgment in ethical terms, because other places who aren't considered as beautiful become sort of, well, you know, not as much focus is placed on them. They aren't worried about in those terms. They thought it's the same in both situations. People are being killed, lives are being ruined, etc., etc. But beauty grants certain places a certain status. So what happens to the other places? Are we thinking, well, that's a sort of great shame that happened there, but it wasn't defended because it wasn't as beautiful. That's what I'm driving at. Beauty being able to do that. We see that in Dubrovnik partly, I think. It's interesting the amount of attention Dubrovnik got not being bombed. I don't know, I need to do more work on that, whether there are rumours or whether there's a truth there. Oxford not being bombed, precisely because the Nazis saw it as something you didn't do. Heidelberg is the German equivalent of that. Talked about, again, I'm not sure on this. Heidelberg talked again about, in similar terms, the Allies were never going to bomb Heidelberg because you don't do that. Extremely interesting, I think, in thinking of the sort of aesthetics-politics relationship. Two sides involved in mass world war against each other, total war, if you like. And yet the aesthetic seemingly being able to occupy this privileged position. They're able to say, well, actually, no, aesthetics is here. In these examples, take invasion was never properly guarded, organised, administered in a way that allowed it to. What am I driving? You know, the sort of point I'm driving at here, that it wasn't given the sort of status that a place, if we found it in the context of Italy, World War II, say, Florence, it wasn't seen as possessing that aesthetic significance. That there's an Orientalist dynamic to play there. So that museum ends up being looted, many things stolen from it, etc., etc., despite the international significance of the works, objects being contained there. Okay, the very end now. Art, then, to sort of close this sense of beauty as a defence and the way in which this sort of art object functions in those terms. Dario Gamboni's work, an interesting work from 1997 called simply The Destruction of Art. He sort of talks about the way in which one side destroying artworks has become a, what he terms, major propaganda weapon that can be used against a different side. That you can point to the sort of barbarism of your enemy if you can point to how they've destroyed things of particular aesthetic significance. And he lists various examples of this. He focuses on World War I partly and looks at the way in which the Germans' destruction of the library at Louvain in Belgium becomes used as a sort of way of sort of pointing to Germany's barbarism, particularly the destruction of the cathedral at Reims. I'm never quite sure how to pronounce Reims. R-H-E-I-M-S, anyone? Is it Reims? Well, that's fine. No one knows more than I do. You know, this is the sort of way in which those acts were used by the French to point to, quote, Teutonic barbarism. And the way in which Germany wanted to destroy Latin civilization. And in 1917, the French put on in Paris a exhibition of what they title assassinated art, art that has been damaged, destroyed partly by the Germans, as a sort of exhibition of this. Italy. Similar strategies at play then, being able to use art to point to the Allies' monstrousness. And this photo was taken on the Greek island. It might be run island of Cyrene, that claimed that the Allies there had systematically vandalised, demolished, harmed. As this photo's supposed to demonstrate, the ancient artefacts on display there. And also in the context of the invasion of Italy itself, publications such as this, the War Against Art, documenting how the Allies in their drive up through Italy had, again, systematically hadn't paid due attention to Italy's art treasures, that they'd sort of set about damaging them, degrading them on purpose. You can point to the barbarism of your enemy, you can attempt to use this in propaganda terms, because you can say, well, they've harmed these beautiful things. Beauty is being deployed as a defence. Okay, I'm going to end it rather curtly there. That's really where my thinking is on this topic. Just to conclude incredibly briefly, what I'm sort of trying to sort of do then is to think about beauty's relationship, obviously, to warfare. Beauty is a sort of active force within warfare, and to think therefore aesthetics' relationship to the political. War is bound to politics, and how though war and politics, the place of aesthetics in those things. And then there's a side category to that, if you like, the relationship between ethics and aesthetics as well. There's the sort of way in which how we think about the war-beauty relationship raises a series of ethical questions that themselves feed into how we think wars should be fought and what politics is. Thank you. I've finished. Thank you.
I've certainly got some comments, but if other people have questions first, that might be a good place to start. Or I'll just talk for a while. Okay.
I'll lead off from the very end where you were talking about some more contemporary acts, and what it struck me is that some of the greatest contemporary acts of symbolic violence occur when the perceived origin of the attacks is from a constructed radical other. So you see the September 11th, yeah. You see that in Baghdad, the construction of Buddhist statues.
Yeah.
But then going back to the beginning, and perhaps the entire paper, is that I wonder if you're really talking about power rather than beauty. So beauty is a constructed act of power. So power defines beauty and excludes other aesthetics.
Yeah.
So the destruction or theft of beauty in war is rather an act of power,
yeah.
Of subordinating one group to the aesthetic of a powerful other.
Mm.
So that in that notion then, what am I saying here? Yeah, particularly when we get back to rape and sexual violence, that's really, I'd argue, more about power than about beauty. And then you bring in the Helen example. Well, could that not be about, again, power and submission?
Yeah.
Either submission to beauty or submission to the sort of masculine violence?
Is that the end? That's the close.
Yeah,
of the I think that's very, very true. These things are always about power. We see power feeding through all these things. But for me, it's not an either-or question. It's not power or beauty. It's the relationship between power and beauty. And, you know, to sort of argue that, well, beauty's not really there, you would then have to say, well, why does beauty get targeted? Well, why? Well, how can beauty act as a sort of defence? So I'm not saying that the sort of power's not there. I think it's fundamentally bound up with these things. In talking about this sort of causes of warfare, you know, we see the sort of the way in which ideology, ethno-nationalist claims, etc., cause war. That's bound up with conceptions of certain groups, possessing certain power. And yet, beauty still comes into that relationship. Beauty figures as a factor in which power plays out on, if you like. But beauty is also a sort of manifestation of power. The beauty is sort of taken of if a culture is able to produce a building that looks like S or this rich tradition of art, then isn't that in itself a manifestation of its power? That's the type of thing I'm trying to get at. I don't know.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you first for this very interesting talk.
Thank you.
I feel you've been very passionate about the subject, and
thank
it is very fascinating.
Thank you.
I just wonder, and this goes a bit in the same direction, if this passion about beauty sometimes leads to a little bit of a bias.
Yeah.
And I fully agree with when it comes to rape. It's very hard for me to see where the beauty comes in, because systematic raping is not about beautiful women singling out for rape, right?
It's like
from a 10-year-old girl to a
70-year-old
woman.
Good point.
And there I see, maybe I wonder if also, do you see that might be a bias in singling out cases where you actually see beauty as a defense mechanism, like in Rome? Maybe neglecting that this was the case with Rome, maybe it's also because it's home of the Catholic Church and its history there. And maybe then neglecting places where despite being beautiful, like Dresden, for example, which is called the El Florence, where this doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to take those two points in turn, I think they're sort of interesting questions. Thank you. I think you're sort of right to point to the question of sexual violence and rape. Is that about beauty particularly? And you're sort of right to point to what you're arguing there. And what I at no point did, you may have noticed, is actually define what beauty is. I didn't say this, you know, you can say, oh, well, he never defined what beauty is. And at this stage, certainly, I'm really breaking down beauty into the beauty of a place, sort of cities and architecture. Beauty is art, and beauty in the feminine. Beauty is bound up with the feminine. And that touches upon the point you're making at the sort of end there. Can we really think in those terms, you know, systematic? Has it got anything to sort of do with beauty? It depends, I suppose, how much you see beauty as bound to the feminine. And it's possible to argue, well, that's something separate. You know, thinking about it in those ways isn't maybe the right way to proceed. And yet, if we look back on the history of aesthetics and beauty, there's a very powerful relation. There's a very deep, profound history of it, thinking of beauty and the feminine as bound together. So it's sort of playing on that, and it's playing on sort of more recent literature that sort of takes up that. Then I suppose it's a question of making a sort of leap to seeing, well, rape, sexual violence as striking at beauty. It depends what you mean by beauty. And certainly, you know, if you think about beauty as bound up with the feminine and something that provokes desire, which certainly is one way beauty has certainly been thought about, not the only way, but it certainly has been, then, you know, it's partly to sort of sexualise beauty, maybe. But I sort of think that there is something there worth talking about. Your sort of other point, which sort of relates to that partly, is a more sort of methodological point, I think. Is that you're saying, well, I'm picking and choosing the examples where beauty figures as a factor. And that if I was less keen to push the beauty thing, if I was more balanced in my thinking, I would say, oh, well, actually, you know, we see a lot of other things going on, da-da-da. Which is a perfectly acceptable point to make. But I'm intentionally trying to tease out beauty here because I'm interested in thinking, well, this sort of category that hasn't been thought about in those terms, if we do focus on it, is there anything interesting to be said there? Now, I'm not trying to argue that, you know, A, certainly, and you aren't saying I'm arguing that it's all about beauty. You're not saying that. I'm not saying here, oh yeah, you know, beauty's the fundamental thing. But I'm interested in trying to provoke, you know, thinking about, well, actually, is there something to what's going on here with beauty? And in so doing that, I do focus on particular examples. Yes.
If I may.
Yeah, please.
It's like this is certainly, and I think it's good that you do this. I think that sometimes can be argued that sometimes it's a little bit an overstretch when you mention like the shelling or of the in Poland of the cathedral of the
yeah.
Mary of
Czechoslovakia. Yeah.
It's basically when you say, well, this was because it's so beautiful, then one could argue, no, it's actually because it's the cathedral of the Mary, who's been actually the symbol of Catholicism, the Polish version, and therefore basically the main symbol of a Polish identity, and therefore I see your point. I just think sometimes it's a little bit dangerous to neglect because when you said it sounded like you downplay the other factors completely.
Yeah, no, I think that's what you're arguing is entirely true, that it, and this is what I'm trying to, it gives me a chance to sort of clarify it. It maybe comes across as I am downplaying the other factors because I'm focusing on beauty here. I'm actually trying not to downplay them. What I'm trying to argue is that partly what you're saying there, in that this monastery cathedral has this symbolic, historical, religious significance. And yet it takes on a certain form, a sort of building. It takes on a certain form, you know, in sort of physical terms. It doesn't just exist as a sort of idea, that a sort of building exists as something that's physical, visible, manifest. And that's where the sort of beauty aspect comes in. It's what's manifest in a monastery or cathedral like that is the beauty of a culture, of exactly the terms you're talking about. It's the manifestation at a visible level, at a concrete physical level. It's the manifestation of that religious, cultural tradition. So to wipe out that religious, cultural tradition, you could ban people worshipping, you can shoot priests, you can do all these things. But that's not all the Nazis did. They also wanted to bomb this site that they didn't need to, really, to wipe out that visible, physical, beautiful presence. Does that... For me, it's not a sort of either-or. It's not an either-or question. It's a symbolic, religious, historical, yes, and beauty.
Just a point, linking a couple of things together, but that you were tackling the idea of what you said, you haven't said, what is beauty?
Yeah.
It seems one of the important things to tackle is that it's not something that's absolute.
Yes.
So, for instance, your idea that linking beauty to the feminine, that the reason there's a whole history that links beauty to the feminine is because the producers, i.e. the artists, and the consumers, i.e. the patrons or the people visiting the works, it's been a patriarchal system.
Yes.
And they're making them, you know, if you...
Yes.
The majority of history and men viewing them. So that, and the majority of men, or you know, a heavy percentage, are heterosexual.
Yes.
Heterosexual men find women beautiful.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that's an absolute value, because a heterosexual woman finds men beautiful.
Yes.
And maybe that's not a term that they use.
Yes.
Because that's been
beauty's there.
Like, tied up.
Yeah, so beauty's there.
Because you then see it as a relative value, perhaps this can link into why more certain places are attacked than certain places aren't, that have clearly like inherent qualities of what we'll call beauty.
Yeah.
So the reasons the Nazis wouldn't attack Rome is because they had any moral value saying, Rome's clearly beautiful, the forces were attacking it's beautiful, so we won't touch it. It's because it actually aligns itself as well to their values.
Yes, yes,
so
exactly.
They're aware that they can eventually, you know, if they're fully successful, take that on and feed it into their culture.
Yeah.
Whereas they're quite happy to bomb the hell out of other places that have values of beauty, because if it doesn't align with Nazi values. So the example like the Louvre and the Napoleonic regime, that they would go around and loot all these numbers of works of art, because they were aware that it had inherent qualities of beauty that they could take from one place, so let's say take from Italy, and the second they put it in Paris, it actually now represents the power of Imperial France.
Exactly.
When you now go around the Louvre, we don't go, I mean, you know,
that was stolen from there, that was taken, but it's not how these things are viewed now.
You get a sense of Paris and France as a cultural centre.
Yes, exactly.
Like the Mona Lisa, we see it as French.
Yes.
I mean, if you ask anyone, though, you wouldn't say it's French.
No. But it's certainly in Paris, it's owned by the French, it's in one of the world's great historical museums, and it contributes to the Louvre being seen as one of the world's great museums.
Like the Elgin Marbles,
that
then they now represent kind of like British civility or British tradition, because we've got them here. So my point more, I suppose it's like a fairly general one, but is that beauty is a relative value both in how we judge it, so that affects, you know, what we would attack or what we would choose not to attack, and that also it's something that can be moved and taken elsewhere. So back to the, say, the 9/11 thing, that obviously there was a very loaded like political, social and symbolic relevance for attacking there.
Yes.
But there was also just it as a beautiful thing in its own right, in its symmetry and in the process of how they attacked it.
Exactly.
I mean, people at Hearst have pulled up as it being a slightly sensationalised comment.
Yes, highly sensationalised for some people,
partly it is to do whatever he can. He's a clever marketing guy. But the truth is as well, actually those attacks were beautiful. And as you said, that doesn't mean they're...
Well, it's not the sort of truth of it. It's that people have seen them as beautiful. I'm not sure there's a truth to them being beautiful. Is it that's contingent on the sort of spectator? I mean, you it's possible to sort of see them as beautiful. What was interesting was the reaction, that if you do say, oh, it was like an artwork, then there's this, oh, you can't say that. It's outraged people died.
I think what's clever is I think on generic Western terms, if you take away emotion, then those attacks were beautiful in terms of our contemporary way of viewing things, and that we find that very uncomfortable. So for instance, if you think of like a current Hollywood film, that we have these two symbols there which are, you know, classic like phallic skyscraper, yeah. symbols of the West.
Yeah.
This kind of like rising up as a point of success. I think Beaujolais calls them like two lines in a stock market graph.
Right.
And one tick, and what we get is right, these things are about permanence and stability.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, this is terrible. It's been hit, but they won't go down. I remember being sat next to an architect.
Yeah.
Definitely won't go down.
Yes, that was the broad thinking on it. Yeah.
And then, so you've got this kind of horizontality hitting the vertical, and then it went down.
Mm.
And then because you've got two, so it's a whole like doubling, and it was the doubling that's inserted. The second one's hit, you know, right, that is going down, and now it's waiting.
Yeah.
And in terms of narrative, and if you think of like current blockbuster films, that's perfectly balanced and controlled.
Mm.
And I would say in contemporary visual aesthetics, that's beautiful. I don't think that's a massively for debate. I think that.
Well, no, I'm.
So the point here, but you're saying the same people are then uncomfortable with that.
Yes.
It's not saying it's a good thing. It's not.
No, it's not. It's not.
It's saying that they very cleverly stage an attack.
That was supposed to attract as much attention as possible. Yeah. And that you can see that as beauty and that it lures people to it.
Yeah.
For me, it's not about whether the thing is beautiful or not. This is why I partly resisted defining beauty. And maybe people maybe think that's a crazy thing to do. You sort of have to define beauty. I mean, maybe when a version of this, when I actually write it, I will decide, yes, of course, I have to define beauty. And I'd probably define beauty in relatively loose terms as that which cultures hold up to be beautiful, that which is generally regarded as being beautiful, is beauty. I don't think there's any objective realm of beauty. I think you can't do that. So it's what cultures define as beautiful. And then this other side to it, because for me even, just saying, oh, well, what cultures define as beautiful, is a bit weak still. And I very much like this idea of beauty's lure. trying to say the word in a clear way. L-U-R-E, lure. Beauty's lure. I'm very interested in that idea of beauty becoming recognised as beauty because it draws people to it. I was in the museum down the road, the Fitzwilliam Museum just before this, and you know, and I'm going around it, and you look at the paintings and you look at the objects, and they draw you to them, partly because you know that they're in a museum and you're supposed to. But the ones that particularly strike me, the ones I'm particularly drawn to, there's something going on there. You're drawn to them for a reason. And that, to me, is beauty at work.